are beginning to bias towards is eventually not having the glucocorticoids doing exactly what they should be doing and perfectly and mediating that recovery period, and you are in danger of spiraling into autoimmunity. And what you also see is get just the right pattern of an excess of glucocorticoids, and you can get into the same trouble, immensely complicated field. And relevant to that, Hans Selye, that guy discussed in the second lecture and first lecture, the guy who's one of the founders of the whole field, Selye got as confused as everybody else as to what glucocorticoids are doing with the immune system, and he made a massive mistake in the 1950s predicting how something was going to work with glucocorticoids and immunity, and it's generally acknowledged that the sheer visibility of that massive mistake had a lot to do with the fact that he never got a Nobel Prize. This is tremendously complicated terrain. So what you see with excessive stress, not lots of the intermittent stressors, but majorly chronic stress, is something very different. Not only do glucocorticoids with each stressor get secreted and bring the immune system back to baseline, but with enough stress, you now have the immune system not only going back to baseline, but being suppressed below where it normally is. And you have this grave phenomenon of immunosuppression. Short-term stress, you enhance immunity. More sustained stress response after enhancing immunity, you return to baseline. Major league chronic stress, and you actually suppress the immune system. And this goes back to, in fact, Selye in the 1930s, once again, one of the first signs of stress-related disease. We heard the main, most famous one earlier on, which is stress increases the risk of ulcers. We now know how much more complicated that is, but stress and ulceration. You saw a second indication, or rather, Selye spotted a second classical sign, which was chronically stressed animals got adrenal glands that were bigger. How come? Because they are working like crazy, pumping out epinephrine and pumping out glucocorticoids. They're working more, they get bigger. But he noticed a third sign that was part of this trio of stress-related disease back in the founding years, which was an immune glands, like the thymus gland, shrink. They atrophy. So we had that first triad, ulcers, adrenal hyperplasia, hypertrophy, and atrophy, shrinking of immune glands. And that absolutely reflects this whole phenomenon of chronic stress, and you are going to massively suppress the immune system. And you get things like the thymus. This is not a subtle effect. Just to give you a sense of this, have yourself a really awful, stressful 3-day weekend, and you're going to come back at the end of it, and your thymus gland is going to be a quarter of the size it was on Friday. This is not subtle. This is like saying, oh, psychosocial stress, and I wipe out 3 out of the 4 chambers of my heart. These are big effects. And a lot of attention has gone into figuring out how this occurs, and it's glucocorticoids, and they, with chronic major league stress, they do all sorts of interesting things. One of the things they do, incredibly hot subject in this field, one that seems quite bizarre, is glucocorticoids kill some cells of the immune system, and how they do it is they turn on genes called suicide genes. They get the cells to do themselves in. There's a painfully fancy term for this process of cells committing suicide. It's called apoptosis. Don't write that down, but it's very, very trendy at this point. But we've got this general theme here. Acute stressor, you activate the immune system. More sustained, you go into the recovery phase of glucocorticoids bringing you back down to baseline, more sustained major league stressor, and now suddenly forget going back to baseline and you get profoundly immunosuppressed. And this begins to explain a very, very major piece of clinical medicine, which is when you've got an autoimmune disease, when you have an inflammatory disease, you want to give somebody glucocorticoids, not some piddly amount to kind of coast it back down to where you started from. Remember, what an autoimmune disease is about is massive overactivity of the immune system, So the notion there is throw in boatloads of glucocorticoids, so it's coming out the wazoo of this person, and what you take is this way overshoot of immune activity into autoimmunity, and you coast it back down. In other words, give somebody synthetic glucocorticoids, and you may be able to do very helpful things for their autoimmune disease, their inflammatory disease. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about synthetic glucocorticoids, also known as corticosteroids. In the everyday sense, when somebody is, quote, put on steroids because of their MS, their rheumatoid arthritis, they're being given glucocorticoids. And we know some of these synthetic ones, hydrocortisone, prednisone, dexamethasone. What you're doing there is taking advantage of sledgehammer of a glucocorticoid dose, and you take this disease of overactive immunity, hyperinflammation, autoimmune attack, and you coast things back down to baseline. Just as a qualifier here, as a caveat, when talking about steroids in this case, these are not the androgenic steroids that get you thrown out of the Olympics. That's the world of testosterone. In this case, steroidal hormones, glucocorticoids are also steroidal. When somebody is taking steroids for their rheumatoid arthritis, they're taking synthetic glucocorticoids, huge doses that are bringing you back to baseline when things are too active. So we see this world where a little bit of glucocorticoids activates the sort you get with transient stressors, a ton of the stuff, way more than your body ever generates during stress, and you can take an overactive immune system and bring it back down to baseline. So think about all the lectures that came before this and all the bad things that glucocorticoids can do when they're in excess. And what you wind up seeing is take these high doses of these synthetic glucocorticoids and you begin to get a lot of the problems that we've heard about in the prior lectures. You get a lot of side effects. Okay, so this very complicated world of stress and autoimmunity and immune suppression and the therapeutic use of synthetic glucocorticoids. Now, somewhere in there, though, you focus on that fact that sort of major stressors, not synthetic glucocorticoids, but major stressors, and you can get your immune system to the point of being suppressed below normal, and suddenly you have the cornerstone concept of psychoneuroimmunology, which is insofar as lots of stress can suppress immunity, lots of stress should impair your immune defenses. And now there's all sorts of infectious diseases that should mow you over. And what's known now a few decades into this field of psychoneuroimmunology is that's exactly how it works for the relatively boring stuff. For example, with chronic stress, the common cold becomes more common. And we all learned that anecdotally back in college where enough all-nighters right before exams and 30 seconds after you come out of your final, you come down with some horrible cold there. Chronic stress, increasing your risk of a cold, impairing your immune defenses against rhinoviruses, how you get nose colds. And this has been well studied in experimental settings and studying immune defenses against rhinovirus infection and the effects of stress on it. One of the most charming examples of how people have studied this was what used to be this research unit in England, their famed cold unit, where volunteers would come and spend a couple of weeks at this idyllic sort of country club research facility where you can either wind up being a control or an experimental and no one would tell you which you were. And at some critical point, they would spritz up your nose, either some placebo or some spray full of rhinovirus, and then they look at various manipulations involving stress, involving stimulation, involves sociality, whatever, and see who gets the nose colds. And they would do, for the most part, very simple things and like wonderfully relaxing. Some of the folks got the lousy experiments where they had to, for example, test the hypothesis, does getting really cold, your body cold, impair your defenses against rhinovirus? They would make subjects stand out there and dump cold water on them while they're standing in their skivvies. And turns out the stressor of hypothermia increases the risk of a cold. Wonderfully insightful studies getting at the mechanisms by which chronic stress can increase your chances of a cold. This facility, this cold unit, was apparently wonderful. People would have a great time at them, unless they got the horrible nose cold standing there in the ice bucket. People would fight to get invited back there. More than one couple emerged from people being there at the same time, where they came back and honeymooned at the cold unit. People get some very surprising realms of pleasure out there. Okay, so chronic stress and the cold. Other realms. Chronic stress and another world of viruses, viruses that infect us and then go latent. For example, herpes viruses. You get a herpes infection and you get a flare-up and then it goes latent for a month, for 50 years. And what's known is one of the things that triggers herpes reactivation, sustained stress. And remarkably, this covers all sorts of realms in rats, social stress, radiation in humans, bereavement, all sorts of things like that. And you activate herpes viruses out of latency. This is brilliant on the part of herpes because what you want to do if you're herpes is take advantage of when the immune system is suppressed by stress. Quick, make a run for it, come out of latency, make lots of copies of yourself, and then go hide again. And remarkably, viruses like herpes virus, it's been discovered, can actually measure your glucocorticoid levels. That's amazing. So we've got stuff like chronic stress with psychoneuroimmunological canonical knowledge there, and it can increase your risk of a nose cold. It can increase your risk of a viral reactivation. How about some bigger stuff? How about, for example, an HIV infection? Somebody is infected with HIV and it has now transitioned to overt AIDS. And what's AIDS about? It's about declining immune function. If you are majorly stressed, does the immune system decline faster, more severely? The jury's out on that one. It looks as if certain personality types, when crossed with major stress, and you get acceleration of that. But now we come to what is absolutely the biggest subject in this whole field of stress and psychoneuroimmunology. The biggest subject, the most important one, the most controversial, the one that really, really dominates some folk wisdom about psychoneuroimmunology: what does stress have to do with cancer? And that will be the subject of the next lecture.
Lecture 11, Stress and Cancer.
We're roughly halfway through this course, and at this juncture, we come to the topic which, in some ways, is the most difficult, I think emotionally the most difficult, a subject that's very complicated, very ultimately sad, which is, what does stress have to do with cancer? Now, what we saw in the last lecture, this whole world of psychoneuroimmunology, was a very simple prediction. Insofar as chronic stress can chronically suppress the immune system, if you are chronically stressed, there are all sorts of infectious diseases that you should now be more at risk of. And as we saw, that's absolutely the case for things like nose colds, for things like viral reactivation, herpes, cold sore flare-ups. What we approach in this talk is the most challenging one in this whole field: what does stress have to do with cancer? Now, in order to approach it, we need to spend a couple of minutes at the beginning here looking over what cancer is in order to see where stress impacts it. Cancer, in the broadest possible terms, cancer is a problem of uncontrolled growth. Cells that are growing much faster than they should, growing as tumors, cells that are growing at the wrong time, uncontrolled, inappropriate growth. Now, when in life do you have perfectly controlled, appropriate growth? It's during development. All you're about then is things growing, things developing. And there are all sorts of genes that regulate growth at different points during fetal life, childhood, all of that. And if everything goes right, somewhere around the points where a particular type of growth has gotten to where it's supposed to be, the relevant genes switch off. And ideally, they are now switched off for the rest of time. So what's cancer? Cancer is when there is accidental reactivation of those growth genes. Many years later in adulthood, cancer is activation of genes that have no business being active anymore. And technical term, and ignore it if you want, these genes, these growth genes which can reactivate and then cause cancer are called oncogenes. But the main point is that what cancer is about is accidental activation, turning the switch on at a point in life where the switch should not be on, resulting in uncontrolled growth in the worst places at the most inappropriate times. So what are the causes of cancers in humans? A whole bunch of the leading causes. One is radiation. One is carcinogens, xenobiotics, which are things out in the world that shouldn't be out there, various toxins. Food that is carcinogenic, food, for example, that has lots of oxygen radicals. Another major source of cancer are when you have mutations in those oncogenes where they turn on, again, when they're not supposed to. Another one is there's certain viruses that can cause cancers. These happen to be rather rare, and what you see is best evidence, one of those viruses isn't enough. You have to have multiple hits. One oncogene mutation isn't enough. You have to have multiple hits. That's the basic picture of what cancer is about. Uncontrolled growth. What you get is an interesting transition in what the biology of cancer is, which is you have this early phase of uncontrolled growth, and that's all about those oncogene things that will determine if the cancer is growing successfully from the cancer standpoint. After a while, there transitions into a second stage, which is these tumors, by definition, are growing like mad at an abnormal rate at an abnormal time. They're hungry. They have very high metabolic rates. And after a while, as cancer progresses, the challenge for the cancer is not so much to activate growth, but to feed the cells. Highly, highly elevated metabolic rates. So one of the things you see with cancer as it progresses is this wild phenomenon, which is cancer cells, tumors, can give out signals which trigger the ingrowth of blood vessels, of capillaries, to supply more nutrients to the tumor, a process called angiogenesis. And a very exciting field of cancer therapeutics these days is the notion of finding angiogenesis inhibitors. If you got a growing tumor and you make it impossible for it to get a new source of energy, you're going to starve it away. So what are some of the classic defenses against cancer? Early phases are immune defenses. And we heard in the last lecture one class of immune cells, natural killer cells, which can go after cancerous cells. There's factors released by immune cells, tumor necrosis factor, things of that sort. With any luck, they can spot a tumor when it's just beginning to be tumorous and wipe it out. So the early stage of defenses against cancer are these immune defenses. As the cancer transitions to that more mature stage, the one as just talked about, where the main thing the cancer is about is getting enough food to grow like crazy, some of the body's defenses are built around trying to starve that tumor. Okay, so that's a general, of course, highly simplified picture of what cancer is about. So now we transition to what stress does to the system. And all we have to do is have stayed awake during the last lecture, and you know the answer. We have the early phases of cancer defenses built around the immune system being active and doing what it's supposed to do. So if chronic stress is dramatically inhibiting the immune system, chronic stress should impair your defenses against cancer. QED, case closed. And it's not hard to construct a sequence there that seems irrefutable, which is lots of stress, and thus you suppress the immune system, and thus your defenses against cancer are impaired, and thus you're more at risk for cancer and tumors grow faster. Absolutely clear sequence, stress to bad immune system to bad defenses against cancer to uncontrolled cancer. Perfectly straightforward. Of course, it's going to turn out to be wildly unstraightforward as we begin to consider the subject. So what's going on? What's going on in terms of cancer progression? In terms of this simple prediction that lots of stress puts you more at risk for cancer? It's obvious how it works. It's very straightforward. Everybody knows how this works. Everybody knows that stress causes cancer. Stress causes cancer. Stress increases the risk of getting cancer. Stress, once you have cancer, makes tumors grow faster. Stress is more likely to cause cancer relapse. Everybody knows this. It's one of the most commonly held beliefs about how cancer biology works and how stress-related disease works, sufficiently so that there, some years ago, there was a paper published in the journal Psycho-Oncology, the interactions between psychology and the cancer process. This paper in 2001, where a bunch of women who had just gotten a very serious breast cancer diagnosis were asked something simple. So what do you think caused your cancer? And we saw a few minutes ago all sorts of possibilities, radiation, carcinogens, mutations, all of that. And by a wide margin, what was the most common answer? Stress. Stress caused my cancer. So we've got this deeply held belief here that stress can cause cancer. So now it's time for us, amid that picture, to start dissecting this belief. First off, what's going on with animals, experimental animals, the world in which you can understand cancer in its greatest detail, the experimental setting in the laboratory, what is found there? Yes, indeed, lots of stress, lots of glucocorticoids. They, of course, were inevitably going to come in on the scene. Lots of stress, lots of glucocorticoids increase the risk of cancer in laboratory animals. And once they have the cancer, what stress does is accelerate the progression of the tumor. And it's reasonably well understood how this works, involving immune defenses being impaired, involving some of those metabolic defenses being impaired. It's reasonably well understood. My lab, in fact, did some of that work some years ago, perfectly straightforward. So we appear to have this slam dunk in the world of experimental laboratory research, stress and cancer, they seem interlinked. So what about humans? What about humans in a broad way? And what we've got right off the bat here inevitably is a really complicated picture. Right off the bat, what we have is lots of reasons to pay no attention to those laboratory studies. For a very simple reason, what causes the cancer in these animal studies? For the most part, you can't sit around and have the 10% of your rats as they get older come down with spontaneous cancer. It's really hard to study that. What you do is you experimentally induce the cancer. What you do is take some cancerous cells and inject it into the lab rat and cancer occurrence. What that's about is whether those cancerous cells take off as a tumor. What cancer progression is about is how fast that tumor grows then, and human cancers are, no surprise, not due to being injected with tumorous cells, as we heard already, viruses, pathogens, radiation, all of that. So immediately there's this disturbing issue as to whether any of the laboratory stuff with lab rats are in fact pertinent to human cancer. So now what we need to do is very carefully dissect what's actually going on. And this is a particularly tough field because, as noted already, lots of folks go into it with some beliefs about how things work, and it has taken some enormously obsessive, aggressively detailed-oriented research to try to pick apart this issue in humans. Some really hard work calling into play epidemiologists who look at patterns of disease in people, statisticians, God help us, who play a critical role figuring out were data analyzed the correct way. Very, very challenging field. So what do we know? First off, what do we know in humans about stress increasing the incidence of cancer? And this appears to be pretty straightforward, which is there is indeed an increased incidence of people with a stress history having a higher likelihood of coming down with cancer. And probably the stressor, the major stressor that's been studied most frequently, is major depression. And as we will see in a few lectures, you cannot begin to understand what's going on in depression outside the context of severe stress. So depression, other stressors, increasing the risk of cancer seems absolutely straightforward, from the cancer in me is due to stress to all the other ways in which people believe there's a connection. This appears to indeed be the case when you look at the data. But there's a problem. There's a problem that's already popped up in a number of these studies and a number of these disciplines that we've heard about, which is these studies are mostly retrospective. In other words, somebody comes down with cancer and you then find out what stressors did they have in their life. Or even more shaky, they come down with cancer and you ask them what stressors have they had in their life. And what we saw in the previous lecture is there's this problem. There's this problem, which is when something bad is going on, our memory is preferentially focused on bad things. When something as awful as a cancer diagnosis is going on and you ask people to say, well, have you had a lot of stress in your life in recent years? People will preferentially remember the bad stuff. And we saw that in the previous lecture, that wildly unlikely who approved this experiment, where people were made to have chronic stomach problems experimentally. The doctor tells them, not truthfully, they've got an ulcer, was anything stressful going on, and suddenly you remember all sorts of stressors. Retrospective data are very, very shaky for those reasons. Even retrospective, like going back through medical records. And what you see is, when you look at cancer patients versus people without cancer, cancer patients remember more stressors prior in life. When you control for, did these two groups actually have the same amount of stress? Cancer patients, a higher rate of remembering stressors than non-cancer patients. Patients with severe cancer at a higher rate than people with less severe ones. Huge problems with this retrospective literature. So then we switch over to what's the gold standard of these sorts of studies, vastly more difficult, what are called prospective studies, which is you sit down with a bunch of people who don't have cancer, who, in order to qualify for these studies, in fact, appear to be perfectly healthy, and now you follow them over the years and see if they come down with cancer. Prospective. You need vast numbers of people in these studies because the incidence of cancer in the time span of these studies tends to be rather low. You need an enormous amount of resources to do these studies. This is the gold standard, doing a prospective study. So when they are done, what has come out of that literature? Number of studies suggesting that, yes indeed, prospectively, lots of stressors in life increase the risk of cancer. But these studies often have some problems in them. For example, there's this one classic one that everybody learned about as this field first emerged, a study of a large number of people working in a Western Electric plant, I believe in Buffalo in New York, where prospective study, and what they showed was focusing in on a classic stressor, as we've already heard, major depression. And what they showed was major depression, as you prospectively go through the study, major depression caused a twofold increase in cancer risk. Not good. Seemingly an absolutely clear, irrefutable connection here between stressors and cancer risk. So that one's the iconic demonstration of it, the classic one, and some years after it was carried out, a very subtle, energetically detailed, focusing, statistically wise guy went and analyzed just the hell out of these data and discovered a very interesting confound in there, which was the people who were working in this Western Electric plant who were getting depressed were mostly getting depressed because they had an awful boss who had them working under unsafe working conditions with lots of exposure to carcinogens. Oh, well, that's kind of a confound. That's kind of hard to evaluate then. This classic study down the drain then in terms of showing a cancer connection. Okay, what else might come out of these prospective studies? You might ask, well, do people who have stressors do you begin to see changes in immune function? What we know is changes, suppression of immune function in a way that now puts you more at risk for cancer. And in general, what these studies have shown is you don't get enormous decreases in immune function. Yes, in the last lecture we heard chronic stress, you can suppress immunity enough that you're now more at risk for a nose cold. Seemingly, the stressors that we think of as increasing the risk of cancer, they don't suppress the immune system anywhere far enough. Because the finding, the reality is, you need to absolutely flatten the immune system to seriously increase your risk of cancer. And this is seen, for example, in HIV, people with AIDS, and one of the things you see is an increased risk of certain types of cancers, one called Kaposi sarcoma. This used to be a cancer you would see in 80-year-olds once in a career, and suddenly it's popping up in a lot of 30-year-olds with AIDS. Okay, severe immune suppression increases the risk of cancer. All things considered is the fact that the immune system is just ground down to nothing in HIV and only a relatively small subset of AIDS patients come down with this cancer, making that same point again. You've got to absolutely push the immune system down to the floor, and on the simplest level, stressors just don't do that. So now we have a greatly weakened viewpoint of stress increasing the likelihood of getting cancer. Okay, how about a next realm of stress? How about the notion that certain personalities increase the risk of cancer? And this has been a wildly controversial field. There has been a long-standing view that there is a certain personality type that increases cancer risk, and these are individuals who are introverted and repressive, and especially repressive about anger, and minimal evidence for this. Minimal evidence, and one of the big problems is that that literature has relied very heavily on retrospective evidence. Furthermore, you see no evidence that these folks with these repressive, cancer-prone personalities have anything screwy about their immune systems. So in general, the literature showing a link between certain personality styles and cancer risk has been pretty unimpressive. Okay, so what we've seen now is there's not a ton of evidence for cancer, the likelihood of getting cancer, the incidence of cancer being stress-related. How about the next step in the progression? You've had cancer, there's been a successful treatment, the cancer has gone into remission. Does stress have anything to do with the likelihood of a relapse, the cancer coming out of remission? And what you see is minimal evidence at best. So now we move over to what in lots of ways is the most controversial issue in the field, which is not what does stress have to do with getting cancer, not does it have to do with a relapse, but what does stress have to do with the rate of progression, the rate at which the cancer grows, the rate at which things get worse? Can stress accelerate cancer progression? And this one is wildly controversial. Except, on first pass, it doesn't appear to be very controversial at all, in that there seems to be some fairly good evidence showing that stress can accelerate cancer progression. Now, the best evidence for that, the one that most caught sort of the public attention and seemed to just reify stress cancer, is to go in with a certain experimental style, which is intervene with cancer patients, do something or other that decreases their levels of stress, and does that slow down the cancer progression? And some studies have looked at this, and there is one classic one carried out by a colleague of mine at Stanford named David Spiegel, who did this study which was published in the late 80s, New England Journal of Medicine, and before it was over with, it was front page news all over the country. Here's what he did. Women who had just gotten a metastatic breast cancer diagnosis. And Spiegel had these women randomized into two different groups. First group got standard medical treatment for the cancer. Second group got standard medical treatment, plus they joined a cancer support group that had intensive group therapy a number of times a week. And when he broke the code, out came the finding that the women who went into the cancer support setting an average of 18 months longer survival than the other group. This was a huge finding. This was a dramatic effect. This was amazing news, and this was immensely exciting. And part of what was immensely exciting was it was absolutely clear how the underlying biology of this would work. And we've already heard this nice supportive group setting of therapy with other cancer patients make you feel less stressed, thus your immune system works better, thus you're better at fighting the cancer, thus you live 18 months longer on the average. Amazing finding, one that just had a huge impact in the field. So what has happened since then? Roughly half the studies that have been carried out since then support the finding, showing that supportive group therapy, various psychotherapeutic interventions slow down cancer progression. About half the studies haven't replicated it. So what's going on there in the cases where, yes, indeed, you are slowing down the cancer progression? What's going on there? Obvious sort of pathway again, better immune defenses thanks to less stress, all of that. Spiegel and his group have looked at whether there are indeed changes in immune function in women with these supportive settings. And there are some changes, but they don't particularly correlate with the cancer outcome. That's been less clear. So what's actually going on here? What's happening? And what we have here is something extraordinarily subtle and very tough to get at. And this is something where Spiegel has been one of the leading thinkers in this area. And this is a man who has a wonderfully sort of research integrity in terms of not getting pulled in by the easy explanations. What might actually be going on? And here we get into what is one of the dirty secrets in cancer therapeutics. Okay. You have cancer, and you're going through treatments, chemotherapy, radiation therapy. It is absolutely clear this is your best chance. Go through it, power through there. And it turns out an awful lot of people with types of cancer seriously diverge from what their treatment is supposed to be like. They are not as compliant as they are supposed to be. They fail to take their medications. They miss doctor's appointments. Something like a quarter of cancer patients seriously diverge from their treatment regime. Why is this a dirty secret in the field? It's obvious. You've got cancer. There's this whole sort of structure in the field, type C personality, people with cancer who are going to fight, and not let the cancer do them in. And if there's a treatment that might help, do it twice as much and just power through there. And suddenly, you got people with cancer who aren't taking their medications as much. Ooh, this looks really bad. Secret, dark secret, very rarely dealt with. Why does this happen? It's obvious why it happens, because most of the cancer treatments make you feel so sick and so awful that it's hard to comply entirely. So what happens in this cancer supportive therapy context? What you've got there is you're sitting around with a bunch of other people going through the same hell you're going through, and they all support each other. And they support each other in terms of compliance. Sitting there saying, did you take your meds today? I know I hate them too. They make me totally nauseous. But you know what? We're both going to take them right now. Have you eaten today? Yeah, I have no appetite either, but we are going to eat. Right after this, you are going to the doctor. You're not going to skip that appointment. When people are in that supportive setting of other cancer sufferers where they're cheering each other on, people become more compliant. And in lots of ways, this might be what's going on in this literature. And again, this is not a stress reduction, better immunity, less cancer. This is a completely roundabout way. What seems to have been one of the strongest links between stress and cancer, it's instead probably a compliance issue. Okay, so of all the classes, all the topics we've had so far, this is the one where I've probably spent the most time going after individual subject, going after it in detail. Why is this important? Why is this such an important topic to go after? Remember that 2001 study? Remember that one where the women with breast cancer asked to attribute their cancer to something or other, and the most common answer was stress. And somewhere in this urban legend, this folk psychology, somewhere in there with this erroneous connection between stress and cancer, something very dangerous and damaging occurs. Something which, frankly, there are all sorts of highly credentialed charlatans out there who take advantage of it. And we know this world, people who flog the notion that here's my brand of stress management, credit cards accepted, that will slow down the progression of your cancer, that will stop your cancer from growing, that will completely reverse it. And what we have here is very little, if any, scientific evidence linking this. And these are not crackpots off in the periphery. These are often some very influential and credentialed medical, biomedical experts. And there's one particular one I want to focus on. And I will bypass his name just out of sort of legalistic prudence here. But this is an individual, a Yale-trained physician, who in the late 1980s had a wildly successful best-selling book looking at this notion, advocating the notion that stress causes cancer and thus stress reduction can slow down cancer progression. And just to be really careful about this, as I read some quotes from this man's book, I am going to actually have them here just so I get them right. Here are some of the quotes in thinking about the causes of disease, the causes of cancer. Quote number one, the fundamental problem most patients face is an inability to love themselves. Next quote, she chose the path of life and as she grew, her cancer shrank. Next quote, patient, I decided to live to be 100 and leave my troubles to God. I really could end the book here because this peace of mind can heal anything. In other words, if you have cancer and it's out of control and it's doing you in and it's killing you, why is that happening? Maybe because you're unable to love yourself, maybe because you didn't choose the path of life, maybe because you didn't grow in the face of adversity, maybe because you decided that you weren't going to leave your troubles to God, maybe because you really didn't want to live to be 100. All these attributions here, all these blaming the victim. And in lots of ways, this person's philosophy is most aptly summed up in, once again, a direct quote and one of the sort of main ones in this book, quote, there are no incurable diseases, only incurable people. And what are you teaching someone when this is happening? You've got somebody on their deathbed with their terminal cancer that has resisted the treatments and progressed. And what this viewpoint teaches is, while you're lying on your deathbed, ooh, too bad I didn't have different priorities in life. Too bad I didn't control my stress. Too bad I didn't choose life. Too bad I couldn't love myself sufficiently. This is where you wind up. Would that it be so that these sort of interventions could cure cancer if only cancer could be stopped, if we were sufficiently brave and sufficiently tenacious and sufficiently filled with love? It doesn't work that way. And this view being flogged by folks who are not crackpots out in left field, but again, often highly credentialed experts, the science simply isn't there. Amid all the diseases that we've had to think about in this course so far, all of these diseases where stress plays an adverse role, this is a domain where it doesn't count. And if you really push the view that it does, ultimately, bad science, bad medicine, ultimately bad ethics, and shame on anyone who would profit from this.
Lecture 12, Stress and Pain.
In this lecture, we are going to look at a subject that's utterly intertwined with stress, which is pain. And this is bidirectional. Stress can cause you to change your sensitivity to pain. Pain constitutes a stressor. We're going to look at the interaction between the two. Okay, by now you know the drill sufficiently so that they could come in here and deflate me and put me in a storage closet, and you could leap right in and go through the dichotomy, short-term, stress response is good news, bad, long-term, it's bad news. As we're going to see the biology of pain, this is the one exception. All right, so we start off with pain. We all hate pain. Pain's a great thing to get rid of. Pain is bad news. Pain is remarkably good news and remarkably helpful when it's occurring at the right time. You generally want some sort of signal coming from the periphery saying, ooh, my big toe is in the fire there. This might be a good time to move it backwards. You need pain signaling you in circumstances where you can fix the situation. And there is a terrible disease where people are born, a rare one, without the ability to feel pain. And what you get is all sorts of things go wrong, even to the extent of these are people who damage their legs, damage their knees, because they don't get the pain feedback telling how much force you should be descending a flight of stairs with. So pain is wonderful when it's occurring in a circumstance where you can actually change your behavior and decrease the source of damage. And as we would well know, when it's circumstances where there's nothing you can do, pain is a misery. Pain is a nightmare. So how does it work? Shifting over to the biology of pain so that we could then appreciate what it is that stress does, pain is actually quite well understood. It starts off with all sorts of outposts in your body, all sorts of sentinels, all sorts of sensors that pick up when something is going wrong. And this could be on the level of your skin. It could be on the level of muscles when you have muscle pain. It could be in various organs when suddenly you have a stomach ache, when suddenly something else feels more serious. In all these cases, what you have to have is something is responsive to a pain signal out there. And it is then able to send that information to your spinal cord and up to your brain. And there you go. So what you have to have are pain sensors. And pain comes in all sorts of different forms. You have sensors, for example, that are sensitive to extreme heat. They will pick up a signal of heat somewhere on your skin, wherever it's relevant, and these receptors, these neurons, these brain cells, wait, these are brain cells out in your skin, this is your nervous system sending projections everywhere. You have these specialized heat-sensitive neurons that pick up that heat, activate, and send the signal on down. Meanwhile, not surprisingly, you have other receptive neurons that do just the opposite. They're sensitive to cold. Meanwhile, there are other ones that are sensitive to pressure, extreme pressure. Ouch, somebody is squeezing your hand. So pressure transducing neurons there, which take that sort of signal and turn that into a different sort of pain perception. There's even pain neurons that respond to things like you've just gotten cut. And this is really a weird one when you think about it. There are certain chemicals which are found inside your cells. And as a general rule, if they're found outside the cells, that's a bad sign because something has sliced that cell open. And as a result of the innards of that cell spilling out, that particular chemical binds to a receptor in another cell nearby and sends a signal, we've been cut. Why is that bizarre? Because what that winds up meaning is when you accidentally get a paper cut and it hurts, you literally are slicing some cells in there in half where they are spilling out their guts. So different types of pain. Very interestingly, there turns out to be an additional type of pain, and this is one that initially seems metaphorical and turns out to be much more literal. You are eating wildly spicy food to the point where it hurts. You've got sweat running down your nose, and you're taking great pleasure in this. Very spicy food hurts. And spice is mediated by a chemical found in spicy food called capsaicin. And people long wondered why spicy food at an extreme can hurt, why spicy food tastes hot. And remarkably, it turns out that this capsaicin, this chemical found in hot peppers, actually activates some of those hot receptor neurons. Spicy food that is hot is literally activating a hot pain system. So how does this work once you've gotten past these receptors? Once you've gotten past that first phase, how is it now processed in your spinal cord on up to your brain? And to appreciate this, we need to shift over to a diagram that's in your guidebook, one that is the dominating model in the field. Wonderful, wonderful insight as to how this system works. In this diagram, we start with part A, up on top. And what we've got are projections of neurons talking to other neurons. Do not panic. This is highly schematic. None of your neurons look this way. What we have is a neuron sitting there in the middle, the one marked X, which sends a projection to the brain. This neuron is sitting in your spinal cord. And when it is stimulated, it sends a signal telling your brain that there's something painful happening. So when does it get stimulated? And you see there are the projections above and below neuron X, those lines coming from neurons somewhere to the left of this diagram. What sort of neurons are those? Those are the pain sentinels. Those are the cold responsive, hot responsive, pressure responsive. So there's two different types of pathways that could wind up stimulating that neuron X. First one, shown up on top, mediates sudden pain. And we see that projection coming from the imaginary neuron on top to the left, its cell body, projecting, sending this cable-like projection to neuron X. And what it does there is it stimulates neuron X. When the neuron that mediates sudden pain gets activated, it stimulates and activates neuron X. Meanwhile, down below in the same diagram, you've got a slow pain pathway, and that's coming from a different type of pain receptive neuron, which activates, in response to a painful stimulus, activates that pathway, which stimulates neuron X also. And soon, your brain gets information that something painful has occurred. This doesn't explain much. And where the subtlety, where the beautiful elegance of this model comes in, is now we transition over to the B part of the diagram, because it's a little more complicated than what I showed you. Now we've got a second neuron on the scene, neuron Y, also found in your spinal cord. Neuron Y sends a projection to neuron X. And what neuron Y does is it inhibits the activity of neuron X and makes neuron X less excitable. So look at what's happening. Back to the sudden pain pathway up on top. Your sudden pain-oriented receptors responding to things like a cut get activated and, as we just saw, send that signal to neuron X and stimulates it. And you feel pain. But at the same time, that same sudden pain neuron up on top has a collateral, a cable that comes off, which also sends a projection to neuron Y and stimulates it. So what happens here? The pain receptive neuron up on top gets stimulated by something painful and stimulates neuron Y and X at the same time. And then with a slight delay, neuron Y turns off neuron X. And what if you just explain why you get a sharp, piercing pain, which then goes away shortly afterward? You touch a pot that's hot and you pull your finger back, you get a paper cut, and it suddenly hurts, and then it goes away. And that's all due to the fact that with a delay, neuron Y is turning off neuron X after that excitation. Meanwhile, still in diagram B, underneath, you've got that slow pain pathway when some pain-evoking stimulus that we tend to subjectively feel as being slow activates that neuron, as we saw before. The projection comes in and stimulates neuron X. You're feeling pain. And just like before, that same neuron has a branch, a collateral going off to neuron Y. But this time, what that collateral does is it inhibits the activity of neuron Y. So what happens? Something painful occurs, activates neuron X, which gets excited, sending a pain signal. And what you're also doing there is you're shutting down neuron Y, which makes it impossible for neuron Y to shut down neuron X. What happens? The pain keeps going. It throbs. This is what chronic throbbing pain is about. So two very different pathways that are pulled out of this diagram. Now, this begins to explain a couple of really interesting things. What this tells you is, suppose you've got a throbbing chronic pain, which is neuron X is activated and neuron Y doesn't have the means to silence neuron X. What would you love to do? Let's stimulate Y so it kicks in and shuts off X. When is that going on? You have a chronic pain, which is what itching is in some circumstances. You've got some horrible itchy mosquito bite. And what do we often do? Don't scratch the mosquito bite. It will get infected. What you do instead is you scratch on either side of it. And what you're doing is you're stimulating that sudden pain pathway, which stimulates Y, which silences X, and the itchiness goes away for a little bit. Another example of this. Suppose you have a chronic pain, throbbing, coming from that lower slow pain pathway, and you want to make it go away, some throbbing pain in your muscles. What do? You go get somebody to pound on your back hard, give you a massage. Because what is done with a really aggressive massaging is you stimulate those acute pain pathways, which activates Y to silence X. Even more examples. You've got a condition where somebody has a lot of trouble delivering energy to cells throughout the body. We heard about that earlier. That's what juvenile diabetes is about. And as a result of that energy depletion, some of your cells begin to die. And for very complex reasons, in a pathway like this, it's the sudden pain pathway neurons that die. What's the consequence of this? You turn on a slow pain pathway, and Y shuts down, and X keeps screaming its head off for long afterward, and it just keeps going and going because you can never shut down that signal with a sharp input. What have you got? Diabetic neuropathy, the fact that pain there just goes on and on. So here we've seen the basic wiring of the system. So how does it begin to play out? There's all sorts of interesting things that happen that underlie an important fact there, which is pain is not that objective of a state. There's a lot of subjectivity that comes into pain perception. For example, you can have a circumstance where you feel pain and there's not even a stimulus, a painful stimulus happening. And a lot of us feel that pain, which is when you're in the dentist chair and the person so much as walks in the room and your teeth are aching. There was no stimulus there. And if you're really hypersensitive, you feel throbbing pain in your gums there simply by hearing the music going on in the office. So that could be a source where, with no actual stimulus, you're feeling pain. Some of those neurons are sending messages up to your brain when there was nothing that stimulated them. Another example, you sit there and instead of experiencing some pure, overt, realistic pain stimulus, hot, cold, whatever, you sit there and you watch the same thing being done to a loved one and you feel their pain. On a certain level, the feeling of pain as an empathetic response, that taps into the same wiring here. As we'll see in a coming lecture, there's another example of this. Clinical depression appears to involve overactivation of a couple of these pain pathways. In other words, psychic pain even has some reality in terms of wiring. So some of the time, you can turn on a pain response when there's absolutely no stimulus. Some of the time, there can be a pain stimulus and you don't even notice it. And let me give you a highly technical example. Suppose somebody takes some really rough sandpaper and unexpectedly sandpapers your rear end over and over, abrading it. This is likely to seem unpleasant. Suppose instead, in some rare abstract scenario, you are abrading your rear end exactly the same way, having enthusiastic sex while on a carpet or whatever, and you don't even notice it. Context makes a huge difference. And then there's some settings where you not only don't notice the pain, where you actually give a subjective interpretation that the pain is good news. Some very poignant examples. First one, you have some soldier in battle that is utterly terrifying, people getting killed left and right, and the person gets shot in their leg. It hurts. This is not a fatal wound. It hurts. And why could this be good news? This means they're injured. They're out of this war. They're being sent to the back lines. This hurts like crazy. But here's the wonderful news. I'm going to survive. Or another example that is quite poignant as well, and this is someone I happen to know with a very serious type of cancer, and at some point they tried an experimental drug. It wasn't quite clear if it was going to work, and if it did work, if this drug started killing some of the tumor cells, things were going to hurt like crazy as those cells died. And a few weeks into it, yes indeed, fortunately this therapy was working, and talking to this friend saying, well, how's this feel? And the response being, it hurts like hell, and that's the greatest news I could possibly get. This is the sign that it's working. So there's this tremendous element of subjectivity going on in there. And how might that subjectivity work? We will see the wiring for that shortly.